Dr. Finkelstein, it's a pleasure to have you today. How are you?
I'm great, Ian. Thank you. How are you?
I'm excellent. I'm wondering how your patients are doing. What are the common complaints that you most often hear?
You know, I think this is probably true for anyone who practices in the primary care field or anyone who's just out to dinner with friends. But pain is probably, some form of chronic pain is probably the thing I see most often. But, you know, it's not just back pain, neck pain. It's headaches, migraines included, arthritis, of course, muscle pain, neurological pain, menstrual pain. I mean, there's just a number of different pain syndromes out there, and all of us have pain at one point or another, but it's ubiquitous, but it's the important thing is when it's chronic, when it's just not, I hurt my back because I lifted something. So that's number one, I would say. Then number two, I would say, is just general fatigue or low energy state. And that could be either basically a physical phenomena. Somebody could be anemic, for instance, or even a mental or emotional. And sleep, I would say, or sleeplessness fits into this category as well. People complain to me all the time about their digestive tract. They are either experiencing indigestion chronically or constipation. Probably those are number one and two. But there's all sorts of other things that go on, inflammatory conditions of the digestive tract, inflammatory bowel disease specifically, or irritable bowel syndrome. I mean, these you hear about just walking in the street, essentially. We're all concerned about disease like cancer. People have heart disease, strokes, circulatory problems that are really important. Diabetes is part of these metabolic syndromes that sometimes are related to the vascular problems that we face. People have trouble breathing, whether it's something straightforward in asthma, which affects a lot of young people, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And then there is the immune system anxiety that we face and the specific conditions associated with those. People around where I live in Westchester County, New York, talk about Lyme disease all the time, but there are autoimmune problems that are really important here. And then lastly, I would say, you know, if I identify these as the big eight, which I do when I write about it, are mood conditions. And just from not just the low energy state I mentioned earlier, but just the anxiety and the dysthymic states that sometimes we might call seasonal affective disorder or bipolar, these are people who really just don't feel well, even if their body is okay. So there's a plenty for a doctor like me to encounter. And the interesting thing as well is that many people have more than one of these. So it always made me think what's going on, you know, beyond just the simplistic, you know, and important though, I'm not saying simplistic as an unimportant thing, but the medical diagnostic process, you know, let's evaluate these. But there seemed to be something else beyond the conventional medical that tied these things together.
The big eight. All right, so it seems almost certain that everybody in the audience who's listening has got at least one of these things. And the big question that you've just asked is, what do they have in common? So what do they have in common? Is there some common culprit here?
Well, you know, this is something that's been, I would say, just really understood from a scientific medical point of view in the last decade or so. But when all these people are studied independently, or their conditions, there's more and more evidence that suggests that the inflammatory balance of those individuals is affected toward the pro-inflammatory state. And it's being, these ailments, these diseases are being reclassified to some extent as inflammatory disorders. The first of this, which really struck me and caught my attention, was heart disease. You know, I always thought coronary artery disease, atherosclerosis, so common. Obviously, it affects people as they age. Almost everyone, by the time they're in their midlife, have some evidence of atherosclerosis, which is hardening of the arteries, calcium deposits, plaques, which include fat molecules. But it's been determined that what's really going on at the level of the arterial lining, which creates the area for the deposition of this junk and that clogs the artery, is an inflammatory process. We all knew years ago that aspirin seemed to be of some value there, but we didn't know exactly why. But we thought primarily it was because the platelets wouldn't stick. But it seems that the anti-inflammatory aspects of aspirin in general and other anti-inflammatory medications have really significant effects. And so coronary artery disease is being reclassified to some extent as an inflammatory condition. Now think about that. That's just mind-boggling. But at least
wow.
It's something new and special in terms of what you can do for yourself.
Well, can you sort of back up a little bit and tell us the science behind inflammation? Isn't inflammation a kind of natural body process? Isn't there something good about inflammation that happens inside the body?
Yes. I mean, you know, you may have caught me say that this is a condition of inflammatory balance, a problem with inflammatory balance toward the pro-inflammatory. So your question is really right on that. The issue is that we want a certain amount of inflammation in our body because that's what protects us to some extent. You twist your knee and it swells up. Well, it doesn't swell up by accident, really, in terms of evolution. It swells up so that it limits your ability to move your knee for a little while so that you don't re-injure it. It
right.
forces you to lay down, and then that allows it to heal. So, you know, one type of inflammation that we're all familiar with is that swelling that occurs when we injure a joint. That's just one. The other is the types of things that go on when we're exposed to infectious diseases. So the immune system and the inflammatory system are very closely related, and there are certain molecules that turn on things that circulate in our bloodstream, ways that there are changes in the way white cells work and everything else works, to target the invading organism, surround it, and destroy it somehow, if not engulf it. So, and those are inflammatory molecules at work. So those are very positive, both of those things. However, unbridled, meaning too much inflammation, leads to joint destruction or arterial damage, as I mentioned before, and many of the other things that are on this list. And so, in fact, all the things that are on the list. So that it's clear that if one targets inflammation or understands inflammation as a cause, that it opens up this window for so many other sort of quote-unquote treatment options, or we'll talk about it, I'm sure, lifestyle options, to rebalance the inflammatory condition to stay in the more neutral zone so that it's, you know, poised and ready to work when you want it to work, but it's not overworking.
So it seems like an acute inflammation might be the body's natural reaction, but if it's chronic, meaning over the long term, that sounds like it's not good.
Right, and exactly. And that's when, you know, the classic example, for instance, is an autoimmune syndrome like rheumatoid arthritis. So arthritis is the operative word. So there's joint destruction. It's called rheumatoid because it was initially discovered in association with an infection in childhood that was called rheumatic fever. And it led to joint swelling and other things, and it seemed that that was sort of the prodrome of this condition that some adults or older children would experience. And so it got this word. That's separate. The issue is the arthritis, the inflammation. And the inflammation there, which is autoimmune, means that there's something still stimulating the immune system to target joints that are healthy and normal. So there's really not a 100% and complete understanding from a medical point of view of why that happens, but we know it does happen. And, you know, doctors throw pills at this stuff. Prednisone is the most well-known anti-inflammatory, but it's very generalized in terms of its application. It's got a lot of side effects, but there are all sorts of other things. There's, you know, if you're watching Phil Mickelson play golf, you know that he has psoriatic arthritis, which is similar, and he's on a fairly potent immunosuppressive. Now, he's doing really well, but that doesn't mean there's not other consequences, and I wish I could talk to him because I think I could help him maybe with some of the other things that go on in his life, and maybe he won't need so much of the medication. But anyway, the idea is that, you know, these inflammatory molecules sometimes really just stay active, this whole inflammatory process. It's not always clear why, and medicines tend to be general Band-Aids, but not necessarily curative.
Right. I'm confused about inflammation and cancer. I mean, we learn about cancer being an abnormal growth of cells. What does that have to do with inflammation?
Well, you know, there's a couple of different ways that inflammation affects cancer. If you think of, here's one that maybe is going to illustrate this the best, even though it's not the most common cancer, it's certainly one a lot of people fear, which is brain cancer. So the skull is a closed space. It's surrounded by bone. The brain inside just fits right. It doesn't really tolerate a lot of extra stuff in there. If a tumor grows in the brain space, it doesn't take long for the pressure inside the skull to increase, and that's when people become symptomatic. But the interesting thing is that the growth of a tumor is only in part due to the size of the tumor mass. What happens around the tumor cell clump, if you will, is inflammation. And because it's irritating, that tumor is growing, it's stealing the blood supply of healthy cells, and therefore some of those healthy cells are dying. In the process of dying, the body knows to clean it up, and they send inflammatory molecules. And so the consequence of a tumor is surrounding inflammation. And so we see that in the brain. But anywhere that tumors occur, there's also surrounding inflammation. But perhaps the more interesting and important aspects of this, because when we think of what I'm talking about, I'm trying to help people understand that there's a way we can not just deal with diseases when we get them, but we can prevent them, is there seems to be an association between chronic low-grade inflammatory state. I'm not talking about these disorders now, just more inflammatory molecules circulating because you're, you know, aggravated more of the time, or you're eating foods that are inflammatory, or you're in some sort of emotional state of pain, which, interestingly enough, creates an inflammatory response. And so let's say you have access there, but the fact is, let's say that's your life. That's all of our lives to some extent, Ian, in fact. So this is relevant for everyone. So there's inflammatory stuff. We tend to be a little bit pro-inflamed, largely due to our diet, but there's many other things and other toxins in the environment. But now there seems to be association between people who are more inflamed and their risk of cancer, all sorts of cancers. And so not only once a tumor develops do we get surrounding inflammation, but it seems that tumors develop because of inflammation. And that's an important thing to know about.
A predictive, yeah. Is there a more or less objective marker of how healthy you are that also helps us determine how inflamed you are? So in other words, is there a blood test out there that would help us predict based on inflammation, what's going to happen to you in terms of how diseased you are? Is there an inflammation marker for a blood test?
Yeah, there are. There are several, as a matter of fact, and I'm going to talk about those. But before I do, let me suggest that anyone who's listening understand the context I want to put this answer into, meaning I don't think that the answer to your question, Ian, is going to be the only answer that's going to be important to the question of how do I know I'm inflamed? Because science is limited. You know, it's good at many things. And it has some answers to questions like this, but often those answers don't apply to everyone. And so what I want to say, sort of almost as a disclaimer, is that if you don't have one of these inflammatory markers that I'll talk about, it doesn't mean you're not inflamed. And that's a really important thing I want to say, because I think the fact of the matter is we should all assume we are inflammatory. We are inflamed, that our balance is off. And the reason to do that is, if you're wrong, meaning you assume you're not, and you are, and you don't take measures to do something about it, you're just letting the risk continue. That doesn't make
sense.
And the other is that the data isn't 100%. And so can't hang our hat on this stuff and assume that our doctors are going to bail us out of everything. So, but let me get back to your question, because I sort of always feel that questions like this deserve real honest answers and direct answers. So there are, you know, the earliest blood test that showed inflammation was, which is not used so much anymore, frankly, but it was the sedimentation rate. It was the rate in time, in seconds, of how long it took red cells to settle down in a test tube. And it seemed like if you were not inflamed, that the red cells would fall through this clear blood nicely. But if you were inflamed, there'd be, you know, sort of like a sticky quality, a viscous quality to the blood because of the inflammatory stuff in there, and the red cells would fall slower. So the elevated sed rate was the first thing the doctors used, and this is going back into the 50s and 60s, and it was pretty nonspecific and somewhat unreliable. But people who had whopping inflammatory conditions like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, would typically have very high sed rates, and it was interesting to note. Since then, though, there have been the development of other tests that are a little bit more sensitive, meaning a little bit more accurate in some ways, and maybe a little bit more helpful in terms of the insights we gain from where then does this inflammation come from. So one of them is C-reactive protein. So it's a protein, and the word reactive in the middle of it, and C is the letter C, is a protein that's normal to some extent, but it tends to elevate in acute inflammatory conditions, like a heart attack, as a matter of fact. So that's really interesting if you think about it. So one of the tests that doctors perform when somebody comes into an emergency room with chest pain is C-reactive protein. So just think about that. So as I was talking before about heart disease and inflammatory, now there's an inflammatory marker that's used because the answer, if it's elevated, is much more suggestive that, in fact, what's going on is a heart attack. That's not the only thing that's used, but that's one of the important things. Related to C-reactive protein, and maybe only now been used for the last 15 years or so, is a molecule called homocysteine. Homocysteine is actually a variant of an amino acid. It normally belongs in our blood. But it's evidence of a metabolic process that isn't very efficient. And it is very closely associated with the degree of inflammation. And it's becoming very clear that people with elevated homocysteine levels, again, not being cleared out of their blood properly, is a marker that they're inflamed, that there's an inflammatory condition, and they're at risk for all sorts of diseases. So you could go to your doctor now. They probably won't perform a sedimentation read anymore, but they might perform, maybe even routinely, a C-reactive protein and a homocysteine level, and they're going to look at the number, and they're going to say you might fall into a class of a high risk. But I want to go back to my original point. The normal levels of those things should not lead you to believe that you're not inflamed.
Got it. Yeah, we can make an assumption that we have a culture and we have a lifestyle that is absolutely inflamed, and that assumption, I think, is a good one. And we're going to talk in our next podcast about what we can do about that. So let's wrap up for now. I very much appreciate the talk about what the common culprit is in inflammation. And we can talk next about what we can do about trying to prevent heart attack and stroke and cancer and diabetes and thyroid problems and neurological conditions and depression and chronic pain and digestive disorders. So thanks for your time today, and let's talk next about what we can do about inflammation as a common culprit of that big eight. Thanks, Doctor.
Thank you, Ian.